A Zoom link and call-in access will be
in broad daylight. The revered Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. Also, Texas Governor Greg Abbott continues to terrorize immigrants and refugees as more and more whole families drown trying to cross the Rio Grande into El Norte. The Chilean pro-democracy platform goes up in flames. What's up next for the left in Chile? And kids return to school in Uvalde as their parents struggle not to imagine the worst happening again. All this coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We broadcast every weekday over the Pacifica Radio Network from the San Francisco Bay Area. We are live today in San Francisco and Los Angeles, and we are happy to have you along. We are profoundly unhappy to see that the deaths continue. The numbers continue to mount of those fleeing the violence that the United States helped to create in Central America, or you name the place. That violence, the people fleeing that violence are dying in accelerating rates. We saw on Friday, I think the death toll is up to some 13 people drowned in the Rio Grande, and that's where we're going to start today's show. As you say, Camila Perez Bustillo, we always need to start at the river in this context with the struggle as it continues to unfold.
Thank you, Dennis, and I think all of us who try to follow these issues, you know, there's moments when you stop and you catch your breath. You know, we experienced that with you when the 53 bodies were found in the truck on the outskirts of San Antonio back in June. There are moments like that, and another one just came over the weekend, you know, got lost in, you know, the coverage of the weekend of Labor Day, which was the death in a single incident at the river of 13 people, apparently several different families. We still don't have details of their names, which we would want to share with you, and their stories. That's the most important thing. We don't know their countries of origin. But what we do know is that every day in the last 6 months, there's been an average of one death at the same crossings throughout the U.S.-Mexico border region, especially in Texas, and particularly because of the policies, the combined effect of the policies of Governor Abbott doing too much and President Biden not doing enough. And it's migrant lives that get lost in between.
And there, I don't think I would be overstating the case, Camilo, to say that there are many spectators, say in the name of the Border Patrol, who are watching, who are observing these deaths, who know they're going to happen. They can tell from where the people go in or what they're looking like that they're going to die. And yet somehow they just keep dying. And it really does speak to the fact of U.S. foreign policy in this context, which is there was a decision made. We've talked about it many times, but I'll never forget it. It formally put into writing by Clinton that the concept is if you make these folks suffer, these folks fleeing violence and war and oppression, if you make them suffer, if you make it hard enough to come in, they'll stop coming. The big lie. It's the big lie, isn't it?
Prevention. That's right. It's prevention through deterrence. Prevention of what? Of people coming without addressing the root causes that force people to make this choice, which is a choice made under the most difficult circumstances possible, especially in the countries of Central America, in Haiti, as we've discussed, you know, consistently with you over the last few months. The bottom line is until those root causes are addressed, people will continue to come. Abbott knows that. Biden knows that. And the bottom line is the bodies and the toll and the deaths will continue to mount, because these are the foreseeable results, the predictable results of current policies. The policy of deterrence has not worked because, you know, again, the bottom line is, until you address the causes, people will always make any effort they can to improve their lives when conditions at home make that impossible. And if the only way to go is to move, they will move, and they will move with their entire families. There are millions of stories like that. Meanwhile, Title 42 continues to be in place, sending people back summarily without even the opportunity to apply for asylum. I mean, the good news is that more people have been admitted within the last year under Biden, you know, for good reasons, and that should continue, but it's not enough. And that's what Governor Abbott is playing on, right? Because Governor Abbott knows that it's not enough, knows that people will continue to come, and that there's no effective response in policy. So those 13 deaths at the border have to be stacked up against all of the other crimes that the Biden administration, the Trump administration, and governors like Abbott are ultimately responsible for, as well as those who rule the countries from which people are fleeing in numbers that we haven't seen since the 1980s. Until things change on the ground in Haiti, in Central America particularly, and all of the damage is undone that the U.S. has wrought there through its policies, the flow will continue and the deaths will continue.
We're speaking with Camilo Perez Bustillo. He is currently the executive director for the San Francisco Bay Area chapter of the National Lawyers Guild. Camilo is an international human rights lawyer, co-chair of the National Lawyers Guild Task Force of the Americas, and he has been on the front line of this. Now, we need to pivot with the governor, Abbott. I want to make one more point, have you make one more point, and then I want to pivot to Uvalde, and then we're going to go international.
Sure.
But he's busy. If all this suffering isn't enough, he's got that program of put them on buses and send them north, send them to Chicago, send them to New York, send them to Washington, D.C. It has to be illegal under international law where you take some people who just fled violence in their homeland, spent days, weeks, maybe had all kinds of violences perpetrated on them. You're going to stick them on a bus? They don't even know where they're going. That's got to be a violation of international law. It's got to be.
And not only that, I mean, let's just think about it from an ethical perspective, from a moral perspective. There's nothing worse than exploiting the desperation and the expectations of people who have no other choice. And that's what's going on. You know, thankfully, by and large, overall, you know, local authorities in New York, in Chicago, in D.C. have responded in a humanitarian way. But of course, all of this is being manipulated by Abbott. He wants to create, you know, the backlash that he and the other Trumpers are riding on. And I think that just the thing that we have to remember here is we need to speak out. We need to have our voices, and we need to be present at the border. That's why we are calling on all of you who are outraged and disturbed by these trends and by this kind of manipulation of human suffering to join us at the border beginning December 2nd, in a couple of months, through December 18th. This is going to culminate on International Migrants Day. We're going to begin at the eastern end of the border at Brownsville and Matamoros, where we made our stand through Witness at the Border against the MPP program, the Remain in Mexico program. Then we're going to continue heading west, culminating in San Diego, Tijuana on December 17th and 18th, where we're going to commemorate International Migrants Day. And each stop along the way at every major border crossing. We will be commemorating, we will be remembering, we will be honoring every migrant who has fallen, the 13 who died the other day, the hundreds and the thousands that have died over the last 30 years of these criminal and cruel policies. Come stand with us. We will be joining with Witness at the Border, we at the National Lawyers Guild San Francisco Bay Area chapter here on Cap Street in the Mission. We'll be joining with Witness at the Border and dozens of other community-based groups to stand for justice at the border. This is a pilgrimage for justice at the border from December 2nd through 18th. Please join us.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the governor and Uvalde. Obviously, he knew what happened. He knew how bad it was from the get-go. He didn't have all the details, but he began that first press conference with a lie. That's why the vicious folks at the Texas Rangers went nuts when Beto showed up to ask some hard questions. But from the get-go, the governor was lying his butt off. And then we saw the way in which the Texas Rangers, so it finally came down to the local police chief, the head of six men, where there were 400 people on scene, was the fall guy. But we know, the suffering is one thing, but we know that there is an ongoing cover-up, that the governor has instructed, it's very clear that the governor has instructed the local DA to do everything possible to suppress any kind of criminal investigation or any kind of information that would really speak to the massive failure of police systems locally and statewide, right? This is an ongoing cover-up. There's a DA there who has got this thing tied down.
This is a cover-up of the local police, and, there's already been outrage about that, in the community of Uvalde, and they've removed, finally, the police chief who was responsible. But meanwhile, it's a cover-up of the role of the state police and of all of the first responders, over 60% of the hundreds of first responders who were on the scene and did nothing were from the Department of Homeland Security, the federal Department of Homeland Security. So this is also a cover-up of what the federal police forces failed to do. These children were treated as if they were disposable, as if they were expendable, because they were children of Mexican descent. They were just as expendable and just as disposable as the migrants who are dying at the river. It's the same logic, it's the same policies, and it's the same authorities and official actors who are responsible. We need to hold them accountable at the river and in Uvalde, which is a border community. How many times have you seen articles about Uvalde that failed to mention the militarized, overwhelming presence of the Border Patrol in the daily life of that community, as well as at the moment of its most horrendous tragedy? And so the failure of the Border Patrol to act and of the DHS first responders to act at Uvalde is part of the same pattern of the failure of border militarization, of the failure of prevention through deterrence. And talk about defund the police, and talk about the George Floyd uprising, and talk about the need to hold the police accountable. In this context, holding the police accountable means holding the Border Patrol and DHS accountable, and ultimately Secretary Mayorkas and the Biden administration. So all of them are implicated, local, state, and federal authorities, just like in Ayotzinapa that we've talked about with the 43 students. It's the same pattern. It's the same communities. It's the same suffering.
And you did mention that the overall landscape, the structure, the scaffolding of this kind of racism at the at the national and local level. This has been part and parcel of Democrats and Republicans, right? This is where the system really breaks down. You can see a little sort of the sand down the hard edges of the Republican version and call it Democratic change. But it's always dealing with this policy and this kind of policy that leads to this suffering that gets sidetracked and then ignored, administration after administration. You remember, I'm remembering now, remember there was all this talk about you couldn't possibly send kids back to that school, right? How could you send kids who witnessed the slaughter and lost half their friends back to the same school? But they did. You remember, everybody forgot about that. I guess they have $54 billion to send for weapons for Ukraine, but they couldn't rebuild this school, so they put up an 8-foot fence.
And they can't keep our most vulnerable children safe in their schools, much less in their neighborhoods. You know, ask the grieving black parents of Chicago or of LA or of Oakland about that. I think the key thing here is this. The convergence that you're pointing to between Democratic and Republican administrations takes us back to the river. It takes us back to the border. That's why one of the messages we're going to be sending, please come find us at www.witnessattheborder.org. The message we're going to be sending in December in this pilgrimage for border justice is that all administrations and authorities need to be held accountable for the same cruelty and the same predictable results, the mounting death toll and the suffering. This began under Clinton, continued under Bush, then was further deepened under Obama, flowered under Trump, and essentially continues today. It's those policies that kill. It's the border itself that kills. It's the border that breeds death. And we are going to be bringing our hearts and our commitment and our conscience to the border. And we ask you to stand with us there. Stand for justice. Stand in solidarity with these children. We're going to be going to Uvalde to pay our respects to the community, the parents, and the children there, and to tell them that they are we and we are them. And that is the essence of what solidarity is about. And that is what we are going to try and plant along this route, beginning December 2nd, culminating December 18th.
All right, I ask this question not being facetious, but when it comes to this issue, what's the difference between, say, a Gavin Newsom and the Texas governor?
You know, let's see what happens with the UFW bill, right? I mean, that the courageous farm workers have been, holding the vigil and the pilgrimage about, right? He's already said he's going to veto it again. I think the bottom line is Newsom has to be held accountable. Biden has to be held accountable. This is not about Democrats and Republicans. This is not about the November midterms. This is about the human lives that lie in the balance. This is about the 13 dead and the hundreds and thousands others that we began talking about. And this is about the need to change our understanding of the border and of migration policy. Neither Democrats nor Republicans are willing to take that on. We have to take that on as a community in solidarity and in struggle.
All right. The people of Chile, my friend, have been fighting this battle at the grassroots level, in the streets, during elections. There were a number of victories coming out of Chile, but there was a major setback. Could you explain what happened and why the progressive vision for a new Chile disappeared before our eyes, evaporated, dried up?
I think this is similar to what you asked about Newsom and Biden. In this case, we have to hold the current, center-left progressive president of Chile, whose election was a historic achievement, Gabriel Boric. We have to hold him accountable for what happened in this vote on Sunday. The bottom line is this, is that the constitution that was being voted on was intended to reflect and satisfy the demands of the popular movement, you know, the national uprising in Chile that brought Boric to power. Unfortunately, that's not how it played out. You know, the actual text did not fully reflect the demands of that movement. And so, you know, the Boric administration, the Boric government is falling short of its own commitments and of its own roots and origins in that popular protest movement. Something similar may happen soon in Colombia that we've talked about, you know, with President Petro. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, both of them look good from the outside, Petro, Boric, in the context of Chile. But, you know, when you look more closely, the question we need to ask is, are these new governments acting in sync with and with respect for the social movements that made their victories possible? And those social movements are going to be holding them responsible, as they held Boric responsible, in effect, in this vote on Sunday. Meanwhile, the struggle continues. Social movements, popular movements in Chile are going to continue to press for a new constitution. What's clear is there's going to have to be a new text. It's not going to be the text that was voted down, that was defeated on Sunday, but the constitutional reform process will continue because popular and social movements will continue to demand it. And Boric is going to have to respond to that pressure.
You know, we have to talk just a little bit of history here, because it was the United States government that set back the Chileans people's really determination for self-determination with the supporting and the CIA-supported overthrow of Salvador Allende. So you can say, right, that this is another example where folks are still recovering from U.S. Dangerous and deadly U.S. intervention in foreign policy. So The struggle that continues in Chile is really, in part, has to do with the United States interceding and interfering with the people's right to self-determination, right? This is another American failure.
Absolutely. It's the continuing legacy of September 11th, 1973, that coup that overthrew the Allende government. Ironically, last Sunday was not just this vote, September 4th, it was also the anniversary, the 52nd anniversary of September 4th, 1970, when Allende was originally elected. And if we remember, you know, and this is all on the website of the National Security Archive and elsewhere, and there's a lot of good journalism about this, you know, Seymour Hersh and others. Way before Allende took office, before he was sworn in, the CIA was already planning his overthrow. And that's the plan that eventually went into action and put the military dictator Pinochet in power. Dictatorships always rely on violence and repression, but their ultimate strength is in fear and terror. And the fear and terror that they cultivated with that coup, with thousands dead and hundreds of thousands displaced and tortured and expelled from the country, that fear continues to govern Chile. Sunday's vote was about fear versus hope. And sadly, on this occasion, fear won. But the hope of the Chilean people ultimately will be stronger. And they've demonstrated that before, eventually overthrowing that dictatorship peacefully, and they showed it again by voting for Boric, and now he has to be held responsible for living up to their expectations and his promises.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. Camilo Perez Bustillo, if people want more information about all the stuff that you mentioned, if they want to get engaged, if they want to know more about what you're up to, Camilo, how do they do that?
Please join us at NLGSF.org. That's the National Lawyers Guild San Francisco Bay Area chapter. So NLGSF.org, and at witnessatthe border.org, and at our Facebook group page. There are over 18,000 members of the Witness at the Border group on Facebook. Join us in the pilgrimage for border justice December 2nd through 18th, and of course we'll be reporting back to you live from that caravan, from that pilgrimage for justice, as you were reporting on the UFW march. Thank you, Dennis.
We will continue. Thank you, Camillo. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about, well, apparently the Israeli army grudgingly acknowledged that it gunned down in broad daylight the revered Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. We're going to talk about that and what really might have happened. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and we turn our attention to the what appears to be the admission by the Israelis that they murdered one of the most significant Palestinian journalists in the Middle East, a Palestinian-American journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh. Joining us to talk about that is Richard Silverstein. Silverstein writes on security and other issues at Tikkun Olam and for numerous other outlets. Richard Silverstein, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us.
Hey, I'm losing you, Dennis. I can't hear you.
Okay, I hope this is a little bit better.
I don't know if it's on my end or your end.
I can hear you fine. So okay, with that in mind, give us the Israelis grudgingly say, maybe we killed her, but, you know, we're not sorry. That's essentially what they're saying.
Well, let's just say that Shireen Abu Akleh was a correspondent for Al Jazeera in Palestine for many, many years, and her voice was very familiar to everybody in Palestine and throughout the Middle East who listened to Al Jazeera news. So this was really an iconic figure, and she was covering unrest in Jenin. Israeli raids on the Palestinian villages always arouse protest and arrest, I mean violence, resistance, and so she was covering that, but she was not anywhere near, as the Israelis are claiming, other Palestinian gunmen who were defending Jenin from the attack. And the claim by the Israelis is that, yes, we did shoot her, we did kill her, but it only happened because she was in the midst of Palestinian gunmen, and it was an accident because we misidentified her as one of the gunmen. And that is preposterous because the sniper who was in the vehicle that killed her could clearly see, A, that there were no Palestinian gunmen anywhere near where she was, and B, she had a press vest and a helmet on, which no Palestinian gunmen have helmets on, and he had to precisely aim the bullet between the helmet and the vest she was wearing, and that's what he did, and that's how he killed her. So it's an insult to her memory. It's an insult to the truth and the facts. And in addition to that, five separate international media outlets did painstaking research and investigation using the video footage, the photographic evidence, the witnesses, the acoustic evidence. They investigated every parameter of this incident and found that there is no other way than that she died than deliberate Israeli murder. So Israeli murdered her, and I should say she was, as you mentioned, a U.S. citizen. The U.S. government has completely abandoned her except for vague statements of concern and asking, not demanding, but asking the Israelis to do a proper investigation, and the Israelis in turn, the prosecutor general for the military said, nothing to see here. There's not going to be any prosecution. There was too much confusion about what happened. We can't ascertain. They even said we can't even tell who the shooter was. It's just, in addition, when they had her funeral, the border police, the Israeli border police, tried to grab her casket out of the hands of the pallbearers because they were waving Palestinian flags. It was just from insult to, I forget what the phrase is, but it went from bad to worse, basically.
Bad to worse, and the worse, and the message of the worse sort of continues. You mentioned the role of the United States government really in suppressing the truth as good soldiers for the Israelis. Could you talk a little bit about what U.S. officials said and how they justified the fact that a journalist with American citizenship and so high profile at Al Jazeera? It used to be, you know, people used to consider Al Jazeera as a terrorist network. It's not a terrorist network. It's it is, I guess, the largest Arab-driven network in the Middle East.
And not only that, but every other media outlet in the Middle East is basically affiliated with a government or a political party. Al Jazeera is independent. It doesn't answer to anyone. Yes, it's in Qatar, and yes, it does get some funding from the rulers of Qatar, but it's unlike any other media outlet in the Middle East. It's independent, it's fair, and it has journalistic standards. And that's one of the reasons why she was so dangerous. There's even a story that the Israelis were so annoyed by her that they would get the soldiers in the camps would get on their PAs and they would mock her voice. They would say the words, the sign off words that she used, and they would pretend that they were her to mock her. And that's the reason why they needed to kill her. She was the voice of Palestine. She was the voice of reason, the voice of Palestinian resistance, but as a journalist, not as a militant or anything like that. And that's why she had to go. And in terms of you want to talk about American response, it's interesting that Shirin Abu Akleh's cousin, whose name is Leila Abu Akleh, she's in the United States, and she tried to get to meet Joe Biden and was refused. And she was at an event at the National Press Club where Tony Blinken spoke. And afterwards, he saw her, came up to her, and reached out his hand, and she refused to take his hand. And she said, I'll shake your hand when you actually do something to honor my aunt's memory. And he's never done anything. He the latest statement that they made is we call upon the Israelis to investigate the issue so that something like this never happens again. Which, since 1948, these incidents have been happening regularly. And in the last 6 months or so, there's a Palestinian murdered almost every day by Israeli raids into these Palestinian villages. So it's ludicrous. The American response is an insult to her and to her memory.
Wow. We're speaking with Richard Silverstein again. He writes on security and other issues at Tikkun Olam and numerous other areas, and writes well about what goes on in Israel and what is happening in that part of the Middle East. Richard, we have a couple of minutes left. Do you want to just give us a brief... you're talking about Palestinians dying on a regular basis. How would you categorize or... talk about what the situation is on the ground now in terms of the occupation, and particularly what's happening in the West Bank with the seizure, the expanded seizure of land, and the support of the settler movement.
Well, the most ludicrous recent development is that the Israeli military administration, they call it Kogot, in the West Bank has decreed that any foreigner who falls in love with a Palestinian must declare their love for the Palestinian to the administration in order for there to be a visa or any kind of visitation. So I like to say that Israel has criminalized childhood because they have 300 Palestinian children in prison against international law. They've criminalized being a Palestinian, and they've criminalized love. I'm laughing, but it's painful. It's just it's unbelievable what they've done.
And they get away with it. And they get away with it. It one If you stop anybody on the street, we know that Palestinians are terrorists, and the Israelis have no choice to defend themselves because they're being forced into the sea. That is a picture that is painted by the stenographers at MSNBC and you name it when it comes to Israel, right? So we have to say that the U.S. press is in part responsible for the Israelis to do whatever the hell they want, not to mention the fact that they're number one recipient of military aid.
The media has amnesia on this issue, and you can't totally blame the media because they're reflecting the confusion and the ignorance of their readers and their listeners. People are too confused because Israelis obscure the truth and reality by throwing out ridiculous things like what we just mentioned about Abu Akleh. They obscure, they put smoke screens out, and the ordinary average person says, I don't know who to believe. It looks like maybe the Palestinians are getting a raw deal, but Israel says that they're getting a raw deal. It's too tiresome to figure out. So the media just follows with that narrative, and they don't delve deeply, and they let Israel slide. And in addition, you have the powerful Israel lobby, which attacks media that do a reasonable job in covering Israel-Palestine, and also lobbies in Congress for the military appropriations, the hundreds of millions and billions that go to Israel for them to buy weapons. So it's a perfect storm of support for Israel, both here and in the world.
You know, before I let you go, this is something I've been thinking about. You know, personally, I have to admit that I'm somebody who believes in less secrecy, not more, that probably 75% of the documents that are made secret by the U.S. government have to do with not wanting to embarrass the United States government. And I can't help but thinking about Trump and the documents, and I'm wondering if some of these secret documents have to do with what we have never yet been able to, if you will, confirm in a very public way, the fact that the United States is fully aware that the Israelis have a renegade nuclear force and an unchecked expanded program that never gets any visits by any atomic investigators. I mean, that could be some of the national security stuff, right? I mean, I just wonder what kinds of things that might be of interest to the people. Anyway, that's
well, he could very well have had NSA documents and reports, and we listen to what the Israelis are doing. We listen to the Iranians, and we have all sorts of ways of following what they're doing and spying on them. So it's very conceivable that he had those sorts of documents at Mar-a-Lago in that safe.
Anything else we need to know at this point? Anything breaking? We got a minute.
Well, I also, you're talking about transparency, I want your audience to realize that Israel has a regime not only of military censorship, but also of gag orders by the police, and almost any story that is remotely embarrassing to Israel, including this one, is either placed under military censorship or gag order, so that the Israeli people themselves can't know what is done in their name. And that's actually one of the roles I play as an independent journalist. I get stories that do have gag orders or military censorship, and I report the truth, and I report the things that Israeli journalists can't report. And it's very important for that kind of role to be played when you have a regime that thrives in the dark and thrives on opacity.
And you've done some powerful reporting. I mean, I'm thinking now about the revelations around the Mexican kids that were the students who were kidnapped, and how were they being surveilled? Wasn't that Israeli technology?
Oh, absolutely. That's a whole interesting story there. They were using Pegasus to intercept the communications of the human rights lawyers, of the parents even of the victims, and then the Attorney General did a botched investigation, and he was the one who bought Pegasus for the intelligence service, and then once he was investigated for being corrupt, he managed to flee to Israel with the help of Pegasus. So it's unbelievable how these things work.
Unbelievable. All right, well, listen, Richard, always appreciate the good information. His name is Richard Silverstein. Again, he blogs and writes at Tikkun Olam and many other sources that you would be interested in checking out. Thanks, Richard, for taking the time to be with us.
Thanks for having me, Dennis. Take care.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. 1 minute, we're going to go to a piece about a local piece here in the Bay Area about more police violence. But I just want to make this point. The corporate press has been like having the lolly-daw, look how stupid Trump is. And you might think he's pretty stupid. I certainly, he's not a friend of mine. But remember, they said he can't get a lawyer. he's going to be in trouble. Nobody wants to work with him anymore. Huh. He's lost. Trump's lost. He's down the drain. Well, apparently, he doesn't need a lawyer. You know why? Because he owns the judges. So, the folks defending him, you know, all those bad lawyers, found the judge he appointed and changed everything. Because ultimately, the bottom line is, here it's Trump, but billionaires, rich people, rich white people in America, don't go to jail. Trump is going to run again because the folks are afraid of him. Makes me sick. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we will take a very short break, and then we'll be back. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The family of Angelo Quinto is planning a rally at 1 p.m. at the California State Building in Oakland tomorrow. That would be Wednesday. Over the long weekend, the Contra Costa District Attorney's Office of Diana Becton released a press release along with a report on the 2020 police killing of Navy veteran Angelo Quinto. Frank Sterling spoke with the Quinto Collins family and their attorneys today to get the latest news.
This is Freewill and Franklin reporting for Flashpoints. Today I'm speaking with the family of Angelo Quinto, the Quinto Collins family. They are here on Flashpoints today because they are asking for the Attorney General of California, Rob Bonta, to take a look at the case of the death of Angelo Quinto as he was being restrained by the Antioch police in December of 2020. Tomorrow, September 7th, they will be gathering outside the California State Building in Oakland, 1515 Clay Street at 1 p.m. to speak out. For those that are not as familiar with the case of Angelo Quinto, which we have covered extensively here on Flashpoints and KPFA over the past 2 years, Angelo Quinto was a Navy veteran and a resident of Antioch, California, and on December 23rd of 2020, he was suffering a mental health crisis. His mother, Cassandra Quinto Collins, and his sister, Bella Quinto Collins, were with him at home and called 911. According to the family and an independent investigation, when police arrived on the scene, they held Angelo in a control position that led to his death by asphyxiation. This occurred when the police held his hands behind his back and bent his legs up behind his back and applied their body weight to him until he lost consciousness and quit breathing. It's been nearly 2 years now since Angelo was killed, and the family is steadfast in their fight for justice. Over the Labor Day weekend, they were dealt a blow by the Contra Costa District Attorney's Office, who released a statement that the officers involved acted lawfully and that no criminal charges will be filed against them. Welcome, Bella, Angelo's sister, Cassandra, Angelo's mother, and Robert, Angelo's father. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
And their legal team, John Burris and Ben Niesenbaum.
Sure. Thank you, Frank.
Thanks for joining us. Can I first get you to react to the press release by the district attorney over the long weekend? And let's start with you, Bella.
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Well, when I first saw the press release or the summary of the report, I was just shocked because, you know, we expected that they would likely not press charges. That's very common, in especially in cases like these where it's not a shooting. And even those are really difficult. But I did not expect the lackluster report that they shared. It was extremely disappointing to just see the degree of misinformation that they so readily spread throughout that report, and a very blatant failure to consider necessary evidence, and ultimately just the fact that they gave foremost consideration to the narrative that the perpetrators provided, which, you know, for the most part ignores my mother, who was in the room. So it's just incredibly disappointing. I can't really express that enough.
Let me follow up on this point.
Go ahead. This is John Burris. Go ahead, John.
Important for the audience to know that we actually work very closely with the district attorney's office. A lot of the materials that we developed through a second autopsy, as well as various discovery that we obtained in our civil case, it was pretty clear that we communicated that to them, and there was very little of any consideration given to it. And that was, I think, Bella is really honing in on, is that they were giving data and documents that would allow them to at least give strong consideration for a criminal trial, a criminal prosecution. But as they wrote the report, it was like it wasn't considered. It would have felt better if you said we looked at that evidence and it didn't make sense or whatever they wanted to say. They didn't. And that's the disturbing component of it, is like they did not consider evidence that had credibility, that was credible, and just ignored it as if they put it aside and did not consider it. And that is probably the most disturbing component of all of this, at least as it relates to the report that was prepared. I think Bella's correct. We didn't have real anticipation that criminal charges would be filed, but we didn't expect that the case, the evidence we presented, would just be ignored. And that part has been very disturbing.
And what this is leading up to for you all as a family is taking it to the next step as far as you're concerned, and that's going to the Attorney General's office, Mr. Bonta, and you have an action plan for tomorrow, Wednesday, the 7th of September, and you're going to be outside the California State Office in Oakland at 1 p.m. Tell us, I guess, Robert, if you would like to, what's this planned action? What are you asking AG Bonta to do in your case?
Yeah, thank you, Frank. Thank you for that. Yes, indeed. So tomorrow at 1 p.m. at 1515 Clay Street in Oakland, we're going to hold a rally to ask the Attorney General to investigate this situation, to investigate Angelo's killing, and look at the evidence again. We think, as John was saying, you know, John and Ben have done just an incredible job in presenting this, but it doesn't matter. Still, we have somebody that's simply not looking at even the evidence that they have produced that doesn't show things going their way. So what we're asking for is a fresh perspective on this and a fresh look at this. And we're really hopeful that the Attorney General, Rob Bonta, will dedicate some resources to making sure that we can find the truth.
And I want to go back to Ben or John again here. What can this do in legal terms, getting the Attorney General involved? Can they decide to press charges on these officers? What can the Attorney General's office do, John or Ben?
You know, it's my understanding that the Attorney General has discretion to make a determination as to whether or not the Contra Costa County District Attorney abused her discretion in not charging the officers. And if so, then they can actually take the case over and they can decide whether or not to institute charges, criminal charges. And I don't know all the ins and outs to that, but I think that's generally what they can do. And that's what we're going to ask be done.
And would the Attorney General then take more into account the evidence that you all have acquired and produced throughout your investigations?
It wouldn't take much to take it into account, right? But I think any fair look at the evidence presents a compelling picture that Mr. Kinto died by asphyxiation. And I think, and we're going to have a lot to say about that tomorrow.
All right. And again, this is 1515 Clay Street tomorrow at 1 p.m. And this is going to be outside the California State Building in Oakland.
Yeah.
Well, let me bring you in, Cassandra. Do you feel like you would like to say something, or are you here for moral support?
Well, I'm speechless, actually. It's a very numbing feeling. It feels like they killed Angelo in front of me the second time, and I could not do anything about it. I was not able to protect him. That is the feeling when the DA announced that she's not going to press charges.
Yeah, it was pretty painful for myself just to knowing the case, and you all, as I do, to read this the report that they released on their website, at least the summary, as Bella said. And again, let me just talk to you, Bella. How are you feeling about going into this? Because I know that you all have been working hard to make sure that Angelo's name has, you know, lives on. His death was not in vain. If you'd like to just run through some of the stuff that you've got done for us as a community here in Antioch and some of the statewide differences you have made.
Thank you. We have tried to get some local measures in place, including a non-police mental health crisis response team in Antioch, and even just body cameras, though we haven't yet gotten the opportunity to address policy, which is probably the most important aspect of that. We at least have that to start with, and we're going to continue moving forward with that. There's more. We've just tried to be of as much support as possible in the community and in several different ways. And one of the big things was the contributing to the effort to truly widely debunk excited delirium, the myth of excited delirium. We were able to work with the Physicians for Human Rights on their report, and we were featured on their webinar going over why it is not just pseudoscience, but junk science, its racist origins, and who created it and for what purpose. We were able to help pass AB 490, which banned restraints that cause positional asphyxia throughout California, which was a major win that we were so fortunate to see happen. And that was 2021. And then this past year, 2022, we worked on AB 1608, which sadly did not pass, but it would separate coroners and sheriff's offices in the 48 counties that haven't done it already, and create much more independence, transparency, and objectivity, impartiality. That's a major thing. That is really inherent in these systems that allow law enforcement to investigate itself or themselves. And then hoping for much more to come. But I think ultimately, though, this really is our attempt at honoring my brother, Cleangelo, and hopefully saving lives and supporting other people who are going through what he went through or what we're going through. Criminal charges is the only way to get justice for his actual killing. So it's really important to us that we take this next step and really put that pressure on AG Bonta, respectfully, because he deserves justice. And it's just ridiculous, the smear campaign, it seems, on him.
And on us.
And on us, yeah.
I mean, being a witness to the crime, to what they did. They're just dismissing, you know, me and Isabella. Especially me. I was in the room the whole time. I know what I saw. I heard what I heard.
And we won't be gaslit.
Exactly. We won't.
I would just jump in if I can. Thank you for that. I mean, the strength of Cassandra and Bella is remarkable. And I just like to say thank you, because thank you for honoring our family with what we may have done. But we have not done that alone. It's really been a group effort. Really, I mean, I cannot say enough. John Burris and Ben Nissenbaum have been just absolutely the best in using the civil process for so much social change. Assemblymember Mike Gibson has been a valiant crusader. Folks in Antioch have been working on this for a long time, so we've jumped on the heels of that and tried to carry out the reforms that were already set there in place. So I just want to take a moment and say it's a community effort. That's what keeps us going, is that we're joining you guys and we're joining the rest of the community in trying to make these changes. The other impacted families have been amazing. I mean, the list goes on and on. So we have these horrible things that happen when some people don't have the courage to take the stance correctly, whether that's the state legislators who failed us in AB 1608, just at the last second because they bought the argument that $1 million is worth giving up civil rights, or whether it's a DA that did not proceed forward with what we think was common sense. However, you know, we'll continue to work with it, and we are just so thankful that the majority of the community has been, I think, active in being part of this.
All right, that is the voice of Robert Collins, and before that, you heard the voice of Bella and Cassandra Quinto Collins. We were also joined by Ben Nussenbaum and John Burris of the Burris Law Firm, who's representing the Quinto family, the Quinto Collins family, in their civil case. Again, a quick reminder, they'll be gathering outside of the California State Building, 1515 Clay Street in Oakland, at 1 p.m. tomorrow. That's Wednesday, September 7th. If you are able to join them, they are inviting everyone out there. Again, everyone, thanks for joining us today on Flashpoints.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.